From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
Slime by Joseph Payne Brennan. It was a great gray-black hood of horror moving over the floor of the sea. It slid through the soft ooze like a monstrous mantle of slime, obscenely animated with questing life. It was by turns viscid and fluid. At times it flattened out and flowed through the carpet of mud like an inky pool. Occasionally it paused, seeming to shrink in upon itself, and reared up out of the ooze, until it resembled an irregular cone or a gigantic hood. Although it possessed no eyes, it had a marvelously developed sense of touch, and it possessed a sensitivity to minute vibrations, which was almost akin to telepathy. It was plastic, essentially shapeless. It could shoot out long tentacles, until it bore resemblance to a nightmare squid or a huge starfish. It could retract itself into a round, flattened disc, or squeeze into an irregular, hunched shape, so that it looked like a black boulder sunk on the bottom of the sea. It had prowled the black water endlessly. It had been formed when the earth and the seas were young. It was almost as old as the ocean itself. It moved through a night which had no beginning and no dissolution. The black sea basin where it lurked had been dark since the world began, an environment only a little less inimical than the stupendous gulfs of interplanetary space. It was animated by a single, unceasing and never satisfied drive, a voracious, insatiable hunger. It could survive for months without food, but minutes after eating, it was as ravenous as ever. Its appetite was appalling and incalculable. On the icy, ink-black floor of the sea, the battle for survival was savage, hideous, and usually brief. But for the shape of moving slime, there was no battle. It ate whatever came its way, regardless of size, shape, or disposition. It absorbed microscopic plankton and giant squid with equal assurance. Had its surface been less fluid, it might have retained the circular scars left by the grappling suckers of the wildly threshing deep-water squid, or the jagged tooth mark of the anachronistic frill shark. But as it was, neither left any evidence of its absorption. When the lifting curtain of living slime swayed out of the mud and closed upon them, their fiercest death throes came to nothing. The horror did not know that. The horror did not know fear. There was nothing to be afraid of. It ate whatever moved or tried not to move, and it had never encountered anything which could in turn eat it. If a squid sucker or a shark's tooth tore into the mass of its viscosity, the rent flowed in upon itself and immediately closed. If a segment was detached, it could be retrieved and absorbed back into the hole. The black mantle reigned supreme in its savage world of slime and silence. It groped greedily and endlessly through the mud, eating and never sleeping, never resting. If it lay still, it was only to trap food which might otherwise be lost. If it rushed with terrifying speed across a slimy bottom, it was never to escape an enemy, but always to flop its hideous fluidity upon its sole and inevitable quarry, food. It had evolved out of the muck and slime of the primitive seafloor, and it was as alien to ordinary terrestrial life as the weird denizens of some wild planet in a distant galaxy. It was an anachronistic experiment of nature, compared to which the saber-toothed tiger, the woolly mammoth, and even Tyrannosaurus, the slashing, murderous king of the great earth, reptiles, were as tame, weak entities. Had it not been for a vast volcanic upheaval on the bottom of the ocean basin, the black horror would have crept out its entire existence on the silent sea ooze without ever manifesting its hideous powers to mankind. Fate, in the form of a violent subterranean explosion covering huge areas of the ocean's floor, hurled it out of the black slime world and sent it spinning towards the surface. Had it been an ordinary deep water fish, it never would have survived the experience. The explosion itself, or the drastic lessening of water pressure as it shot towards the surface, would have destroyed it. But it was no ordinary fish. Its viscosity, or plasticity, or whatever it was that constituted its essentially amoebic structure, permitted it to survive. It reached the surface slightly stunned and flopped on the surging waters like a great blob of black blubber. Immense waves stirred up by the subterranean explosion swept it swiftly towards shore, and because it was somewhat stunned, it did not try to resist the roaring mountains of water. Along with scattered ash, pumice, and the puffed bodies of dead fish, the black horror was hurled towards a beach. The huge wave carried it more than a mile inland, far beyond the strip of sandy shore, and deposited in the midst of a deep brackish swamp area. As luck would have it, the submarine explosion and subsequent tidal wave took place at night, and therefore the slime horror was not immediately subjected to a new and hateful experience. Light. Although the midnight darkness of the storm-lashed swamp did not begin to compare with the Stygian blackness of the sea bottom, where even violet rays of the spectrum could not penetrate, the marsh darkness was nevertheless deep and intense. As the water of the great wave receded, sluicing through the thorn jungle and back out to sea, the black horror clung to a mud bank surrounded by a rank growth of cattails. It was aware of the sudden, suddenly change in its environment, and for some time it lay motionless, concentrating its attention on obscure internal readjustment, which the absence of crushing pressure and a surrounding cloak of frigid seawater demanded. Its adaptability was incredible and horrifying. It achieved in a few hours what an ordinary creature could have attained only through a process of gradual evolution. 3 hours after the gigantic wave flopped it onto the mud bank, it had undergone swift organic changes which left it relatively at ease in its new environment. In fact, it felt lighter and more mobile than it had ever before in its sea basin existence. As it flung out feelers and attuned itself to the minutest vibrations and emanations of the swamp area, its pristine hunger drive reasserted itself with overwhelming urgency. And the tail, which its sensory apparatus returned to the monstrous something which served it as a brain, excited it tremendously. It sensed at once that the swamp was filled with luscious tidbits of quivering food, more food, and food of a greater variety than it had ever encountered on the cold floor of the sea. Its savage, incessant hunger seemed unbearable. Its slimy mass was swept by a shuddering wave of anticipation. Sliding off the mud bank, it slithered over the cattails into an adjacent area consisting of deep black pools interspersed with waterlogged tussocks. Weed stalks stuck up out of the water, and the decayed trunks of fallen trees floated half-submerged in the larger pools. Ravenous with hunger, it sloshed into the bog area, flicking its tentacles about. Within minutes, it had snatched up several fat frogs and a number of small fish. These, however, merely titillated its appetite. Its hunger turned into a kind of ecstatic fury. It commenced a systematic hunt, plunging to the bottom of each pool and quickly but carefully exploring every inch of its oozy bottom. The first creature of any size which it encountered was a muskrat. An immense curtain of adhesive slime suddenly swept out of the darkness, closed upon it, and squeezed. Heartened and whetted by its find, the hood of horror rummaged the rank pools with renewed zeal. When it surfaced, it carefully probed the tussocks for anything that might have escaped it in the water. Once it snatched up a small bird nesting in some swamp grass. Occasionally, it slithered up the crisscross trunks of fallen trees, bearing them down with its unspeakable slimy bulk, and hung briefly suspended like a great dripping curtain of black marsh mud. It was approaching a somewhat less swampy and more deeply wooded area, when it gradually became aware of a subtle change in its new environment. It paused, hesitating, and remained half in and half out of a small pond near the edge of the nearest trees. Although it had absorbed 25 or 30 pounds of food in the form of frogs, fish, water snakes, the muskrat, and a few smaller creatures, its fierce hunger had not left it. Its monstrous appetite urged it on, and yet something held it anchored in the pond. What it sensed, but could not literally see, was the rising sun spreading a gray light over the swamp. The horror had never encountered any illumination except that generated by the grotesque phosphorescent appendages of various deep-sea fishes. Natural light was totally unknown to it. As the dawn light strengthened, breaking through the scattered storm clouds, the black slime monster, fresh from the inky floor of the sea, sensed that something utterly unknown was flooding in upon it. Light was hateful to it. It cast out quick feelers, hoping to catch and crush this light. But the more frenzied its efforts became, the more intense became the abhorrent aura surrounding it. At length, as the sun rose visibly above the trees, the horror, in baffled rage rather than in fear, grudgingly slid back into the pond and buried into the soft ooze of its bottom. There it remained while the sun shone and the small creatures of the swamp ventured forth on furtive errands. A few miles away from Wharton Swamp, in the small town of Clinton Center, Henry Hossing sleepily crawled out of the improvised alley shack, which had afforded him a degree of shelter for the night, and stumbled into the street. Passing a hand across his rheumy eyes, he scratched the stubble on his cheek and blinked listlessly at the rising sun. He had not slept well. The storm of the night before had kept him awake. Besides, he had gone to bed hungry, and that never agreed with him. Glancing furtively along the street, he walked slouched forward, with his head bent down, and most of the time he kept his eyes on the walk around the gutter in the hopes of spotting a chance coin. Clinton Center had not been kind to him. The houndouts were sparse, and only yesterday he had been warned out of town by one of the local policemen. Grumbling to himself, he reached the end of the street and started to cross. Suddenly he stooped quickly and snatched up something from the edge of the pavement. It was a crumpled green bill, and as he frantically unfolded it, a look of stupefied rapture spread across his bristly face. $10. More money than he had possessed at any one time in months. Stowing it carefully in the one good pocket of his seedy gray jacket, he crossed the street with a swift stride. Instead of sweeping the sidewalks, his eyes now darted along the rows of stores and restaurants. He paused at one restaurant, hesitated, and finally went on until he found another, less pretentious one, a few blocks away. When he sat down, the counterman shook his head. "Get going, bud. No free coffee today." With a wide grin, the hobo produced a $10 bill and spread it on the counter. "That covers a good breakfast here, partner." The counterman seemed irritated. "Okay, okay. What do you have?" He eyed the bill suspiciously. Henry Hossing ordered orange juice, toast, ham and eggs, oatmeal, melon, and coffee. When it appeared, he ate every bit of it, ordered 3 additional cups of coffee, paid the check as if $2 breakfast were customary with him, and then sauntered back to the street. Shortly after noon, after his $3 lunch, he saw the liquor store. For a few minutes, he stood across the street from it, fingering his $5 bill. Finally, he crossed with an abstracted smile, entered, and bought a quart of rye. He hesitated on the sidewalk, debating whether or not he should return to the little shack in the side alley. After a minute or two of indecision, he decided against it and struck out instead for Wharton Swamp. The local police were far less likely to disturb him there, and since the skies were clearing and the weather mild, there was little immediate need of shelter. Angling off the highway, which skirted the swamp several miles from town, he crossed a marshy meadow, pushed through a fringe of bush, and sat down under a sweet gum tree which bordered a deeply wooded area. By late afternoon, he had achieved a quite cheerful glow, and he had little inclination to return to Clinton Center. Rousing himself from reverie, he stumbled about collecting enough wood for a small fire and went back to his sylvan seat under the sweet gum. He slept briefly at dusk, descended, but finally bestirred himself again to build a fire as deeper shadows fell over the swamp. Then he returned to a swiftly diminishing bottle. He was suspended in a warm net of inflamed fantasy when something abruptly broke the spell and brought him back to earth. The flickering flames of his fire had dwindled down until now only a dim, eerie glow illuminated the immediate area under the sweet gum. He saw nothing, and at the moment heard nothing, and yet he was filled with a sudden and profound sense of lurking menace. He stood up, staggering, leaned back against the sweet gum, and peered fearfully into the shadows, in the deep darkness beyond the waning arc of firelight. He could distinguish nothing that had any discernible form or color. Then he detected the stench and shuddered. In spite of the reek of cheap whiskey which clung around him, the smell was overpowering. It was heavy, fulsome, fetid, alien, and utterly repellent. It was vaguely fish-like, but otherwise beyond any known comparison. As he stood trembling under the sweet gum, Henry Hossing thought of something dead, which had lain for long ages at the bottom of the sea. Filled with mounting alarm, he looked around for some wood which he might add to the dying fire. All he could find nearby, however, were a few twigs. He threw these on, and the flames licked up briefly and subsided. He listened and heard, or imagined he heard, an odd sort of slithering sound in the nearby bushes. It seemed to retreat slightly as the flames shot up. Genuine terror took possession of him. He knew that he was in no condition to flee. And now he came to the horrifying conclusion that whatever unspeakable menace waited in the surrounding darkness was temporarily held at bay only by the falling gleam of his little fire. Frantically, he looked around for more wood, but there was none. None, that is, within the faint glow of firelight, and he dared not venture beyond. He began to tremble uncontrollably. He tried to scream, but no sound came out of his tightened throat. The ghastly stench became stronger, and now he was sure that he could hear a strange sliding, slithering sound in the black shadows beyond the remaining spark of firelight. He stood frozen in absolute, helpless panic as a tiny fire smoldered down into darkness. At the last instant, a charred bit of wood broke apart, sending up a few sparks, and in that flicker of final light, he glimpsed the horror. It had already glided out of the bushes, and now it rushed across a small clearing with nightmare speed. It was a final incarnation of all the fears, shuddering apprehensions, and bad dreams which Henry Hossing had ever known in his life. It was a fiend from the pit of hell, come to claim him at last. A terrible ringing scream burst from his throat, but it was smothered before it was finished, as the black shape of slime fastened upon him with irresistible force. Giles Gauss, old man Gauss, got out of bed after 8 hours of fitful tossing and intermittent nightmares, and grouchily brewed coffee in the kitchen of his dilapidated farmhouse on the edge of Wharton's Swamp. Half the night, it seemed, the stench of stale seawater had permeated the house. His interrupted sleep had been full of foreboding, full of shadowy and evil portents. Muttering to himself, he finished breakfast, took a milk pail from the pantry, and started for the barn where he kept his single cow. As he approached the barn, the strange, offensive odor which had plagued him during the night assailed his nostrils anew. Wharton's Swamp. That's what it is, he told himself, and he shook his fist at it. When he entered the barn, the stench was stronger than ever. Scowling, he strode towards the rickety stall where he kept the cow, Sari. Then he stood still and stared. Sari was gone. The stall was empty. He re-entered the barnyard. Sari, he called. Rushing back into the barn, he inspected the stall. The rancid reek of the sea was strong here, and now he noticed a kind of shine on the floor. Bending closer, he saw that it was a slick coat of glistening slime, as if some unspeakable creature covered with ooze had crept in and out of the stall. This discovery, coupled with the weird disappearance of Sari, was too much for his jangled nerves. With a wild yell, he ran out of the barn and started for Clinton Center, 2 miles away. His reception in the town enraged him. When he tried to tell people about the disappearance of his cow, Sari, about the reek of sea and ooze in his barn the night before, they laughed at him. The more impolite ones, that is. Most of the others patiently heard him out and then winked and touched their heads significantly when he was out of sight. One man, the druggist, Jim Jellinson, seemed mildly interested. He said that as he was coming through his backyard from the garage late the previous evening, he had heard a fearful shriek somewhere in the distant darkness. It might, he averred, have come from the direction of Wharton's Swamp, but it had not been repeated, and eventually he had dismissed it from his mind. When old man Gauss started for home late in the afternoon, he was filled with sullen, resentful bitterness. They thought he was crazy, huh? Well, Sari was gone. They couldn't explain that away, could they? They explained the smell by saying it was dead fish cast up by the big waves, which had washed into the swamp during the storm. Well, maybe. And the slime on his barn floor, they said, was snails. Snails. As if any he'd ever seen could cause that much slime. As he was nearing home, he met Rupert Barnaby, his nearest neighbor. Rupert was carrying a rifle, and he was accompanied by Jib, his hound. Although there had been an element of bad blood between the two bachelor neighbors for some time, old man Gauss, much to Barnaby's surprise, nodded and stopped. "Evening hunt, neighbor?" Barnaby nodded. "Thought Jib might start up a coon. Moon later, likely." "My cow's gone," old man Gauss said abruptly. "If you should see her," he paused, "but I don't think you will." Barnaby, bewildered, stared at him. what you gettin' at?" Old Man Gauss repeated what he had been telling all day in Clinton Center. He shook his head when he finished, adding, "I wouldn't go hunting in that swamp tonight for $10,000. Rupert Barnaby threw back his head and laughed. He was a big man, muscular, resourceful, and level-headed, little given to even mild flights of the imagination. "Gauss," he laughed, "no use you giving me those spook stories. Your cow got loose and wandered off. Why, I ain't even seen a bobcat in that swamp for over a year." Old Man Gauss set his lips in a grim line. "Maybe," he said as he turned away, "you'll see something worse than a wildcat in that swamp tonight." Shaking his head, Barnaby took after his impatient hound. Old Man Gauss was getting queer, all right. One of these days he'd probably go off altogether and have to be locked up. Jib ran ahead, sniffing, darting from one ditch to another. As twilight closed in, Barnaby angled off the main road onto a twisting path which led into Wharton Swamp. He loved hunting. He would rather tramp through the brush than sit home in an easy chair. And even if an evening's foray turned up nothing, he didn't particularly mind. Actually, he made out quite well. At least half his meat supply consisted of the rabbits, raccoons, and occasional deer, which he brought down in Wharton Swamp. When the moon rose, he was deep in the swamp. Twice, Jib started off after rabbits, but both times he returned quickly, looking somewhat sheepish. Something about his actions began to puzzle Barnaby. The dog seemed reluctant to move ahead. He hung directly in front of the hunter. Once Barnaby tripped over him and immediately fell headlong. The hunter paused finally, frowning, and looked ahead. The swamp appeared no different than usual. True, a rather offensive stench hung over it, but that was merely a result of the big waves which had splashed far inland during the recent storm. Probably an accumulation of seaweed, and the decaying bodies of some dead fish lay rotting in the stagnant pools of the swamp. Barnaby spoke sharply to the dog. "What ails you, boy? Get now. You trip me again, you'll get a boot." The dog started ahead some distance, but with an air of reluctance. He sniffed the clumps of marsh grass in a perfunctory manner and seemed to have lost interest in the hunt. Barnaby grew exasperated. Even when they discovered the fresh track of a raccoon in a soft mud near a little pool, Jib manifested only slight interest. He did run on ahead a little further, however, and Barnaby began to hope that as they closed in he would regain his customary enthusiasm. In this he was mistaken. As they approached a thickly wooded area, latticed with tree thorns and covered with a heavy growth of cattails, the dog suddenly crouched in the shadows and refused to budge. Barnaby was sure that the raccoon had taken refuge in the nearby thickets. The dog's unheard-of conduct infuriated him. After a number of sharp cuffs, Jib rose stiffly and moved ahead. The hair on his neck bristled up like a lion's mane. Swearing to himself, Barnaby pushed into the darkened thickets after him. It was quite black under the trees, in spite of the moonlight, and he moved cautiously in order to avoid stepping into a pool. Suddenly, with a frantic yelp of terror, Jib literally darted between his legs and shot out of the thickets. He ran on, howling weirdly as he went. For the first time that evening, Barnaby experienced a thrill of fear. In all his previous experience, Jib had never turned tail. On one occasion, he even plunged in after a sizable bear. Scowling into the deep darkness, Barnaby could see nothing. There was no baleful eyes glaring at him. As his own eyes tried to penetrate the surrounding blackness, he recalled Old Man Gauss's warning with a bitter grimace. The old fool happened to spot Jib streaking out of the swamp. Barnaby would never hear the end of it. The thought of this angered him. He pushed ahead now with a feeling of sullen rage for whatever had terrified the dog. A good rifle shot would solve the mystery. All at once he stopped and listened. From the darkness immediately ahead, he detected an odd sound, as if a large bulk were being dragged over the cattails. He hesitated, unable to see anything, stoutly resisting an idiotic impulse to flee. The black darkness and the slimy stench of stagnant pools here in the thickets seemed to be suffocating him. His heart began to pound as a slithering noise came closer. Every instinct told him to turn and run, but a kind of desperate stubbornness held him rooted to the spot. The sound grew louder, and suddenly he was positive that something deadly and formidable was rushing towards him through the thickets with accelerated speed. Throwing up his rifle, he pointed at the direction of the sound and fired. In the brief flash of the rifle, he saw something black and enormous and glistening, like a great flapping hood, break through the final thicket. It seemed to be rolling towards him, and it was moving with nightmare swiftness. He wanted to scream and run, but even as the horror rushed towards him, he understood that flight at this point would be futile. Even though the blood seemed to have congealed in his veins, he held the rifle pointed up and kept on firing. The shots had no more visible effect than so many pebbles launched from a slingshot. At the last instant, his nerves broke, and he tried to escape, but the monstrous hood lunged upon him, flapped over him, and squeezed, and his attempt at a scream turned into a tiny gurgle in his throat. Old Man Gauss got up early after another uneasy night and walked out to inspect the barnyard area. Nothing further seemed amiss, but there was still no sign of Sari. And that detestable odor arose from the direction of Wharton's swamp when the wind was right. After breakfast, Gauss set out for Rupert Barnaby's place, a mile or so distant along the road. He wasn't sure himself what he expected to find. When he reached Barnaby's small but neat frame house, all was quiet. Too quiet. Usually Barnaby was up and about soon after sunrise. On a sudden impulse, Gauss walked up the path and rapped on the front door. He waited, and there was no reply. He knocked again, and after another pause, stepped off the porch. Jib, Barnaby's hound, slunk around the side of the house. Ordinarily, he would bound about and bark, but today he stood motionless, or nearly so. He was trembling, and stared at Gauss. The dog had a cowed, frightened, guilty air which was entirely alien to him. "Where's Rupe?" Gauss called to him. "Go get Rupe." Instead of starting off, the dog threw back his head and emitted an eerie, long-drawn howl. Gauss shivered. With a backward glance at the silent house, he started off down the road. Now, maybe they'd listen to him, he thought grimly. The day before, they had laughed about the disappearance of Sari. Maybe they wouldn't laugh so easily when he told them that Rupert Barnaby had gone into Wharton's swamp with his dog, and that the dog had come back alone. When Police Chief Miles Underbeck saw Old Man Gauss come into headquarters in Clinton Center, he sat back and sighed heavily. He was busy this morning, and undoubtedly Old Man Gauss was coming in to inquire about the infernal cow of his that had wandered off. The old eccentric had a new and startling report, however. He claimed that Rupert Barnaby was missing. He'd gone into the swamp the night before. Gauss insisted and had not returned. When Chief Underbeck questioned him closely, Gauss admitted that he wasn't positive Barnaby hadn't returned. It was barely possible that he had returned home very early in the morning and then left again before Gauss arrived. But Gauss fixed his flashing eyes on the chief and shook his head. "He never came out, I tell you. That dog of his knows. Howled, he did, like a dog howls for the dead. Whatever come to took Sari, got Barnaby in the swamp last night. Chief Underbeck was not an excitable man. Gauss's burst of melodrama irritated him and left him unimpressed. Somewhat gruffly, he promised to look into the matter if Barnaby had not turned up by evening. Barnaby, he pointed out, knew the swamp better than anyone else in the county, and he was perfectly capable of taking care of himself. Probably, the chief suggested, he had sent the dog home and gone somewhere else after finishing his hunt the evening before. The chances were he'd be back by supper time. Old man Gauss shook his head with a kind of fatalistic skepticism. Vouching that events would soon prove his fears well-founded, he shambled grouchily out of the station. The day passed, and there was no sign of Rupert Barnaby. At 6 o'clock, old man Gauss grimly marched into the Crown, Clinton Center's second-rung hotel, and registered for a room. At 7 o'clock, Chief Underbeck dispatched a prowl car to Barnaby's place. He waited impatiently for its return, drumming on the desk, disinterestedly shuffling through a sheaf of reports which had accumulated during the day. The prowl car returned shortly before 8. Sergeant Grimes made his report. "Nobody there, sir. Place locked up tight. Searched the grounds. All we saw was Barnaby's dog. Howled and ran off as if the devil were on his tail." Chief Underbrook was troubled. If Barnaby was missing, a search should be started at once. But it was already getting dark, and portions of Wharton Swamp were very nearly impassable even during the day. Besides, there was no proof that Barnaby had not gone off for a visit, perhaps to nearby Statenville, for instance, to call on a crony and stay overnight. By 9 o'clock, he had decided to postpone any action till morning. A search now would probably be futile in any case. The swamp offered too many obstacles. If Barnaby had not turned up by morning, and there was no report that he had been seen elsewhere, a systematic search of the marsh could begin. Not long after he had arrived at this decision, and as he was somewhat wearily preparing to leave headquarters and go home, a new and genuinely alarming interruption took place. Shortly before 9:30, a car braked to a sudden stop outside headquarters. An elderly man hurried in, supporting by the arm a sobbing, hysterical young girl. Her skirt and stockings were torn, and there were a number of scratches on her face. After assisting her to a chair, the man turned to Chief Underbeck and the other officers who gathered around. "Picked her up on the highway out near Wharton Swamp, screaming at the top of her lungs." He wiped his forehead. "She ran right in front of my car. Missed her by a miracle. She was so crazy with fear, I couldn't make sense out of what she said. Seems like something grabbed her boyfriend in the bushes out there. Anyway, I got her in the car without much trouble, and I guess I broke a speed law getting here." Chief Underbeck surveyed the man keenly. He was obviously shaken himself, and since he did not appear to be concealing anything, the chief turned to the girl. He spoke soothingly, doing his best to reassure her, and at length she composed herself sufficiently to tell her story. Her name was Dolores Rell, and she lived in nearby Statenville. Earlier in the evening, she had gone riding with her fiancé, Jason Buckmeist of Clinton Center. As Jason was driving along the highway adjacent to Wharton Swamp, she had remarked that she had early evening moonlight looked very romantic over the marsh. Jason had stopped the car, and after they had surveyed the scene for some minutes, he suggested that since the evening was warm, a brief stroll in the moonlight might be fun. Dolores had been reluctant to leave the car, but at length had been persuaded to take a short walk along the edge of the marsh, where the terrain was relatively firm. As the couple were walking along under the trees, perhaps 20 yards or so from the car, Dolores became aware of an unpleasant odor and wanted to turn back. Jason, however, told her she only imagined it and insisted on going further. As the trees grew closer together, They walked Indian file, Jason taking the lead. Suddenly, she said, they both heard something swishing through the brush towards them. Jason told her not to be frightened, that it was probably someone's cow. As it came closer, however, it seemed to be moving with incredible speed, and it didn't seem to be making the kind of noise a cow would make. At the last second, Jason whirled with a cry of fear and told her to run. Before she could move, she saw a monstrous something rushing under the trees in the dim moonlight. For an instant, she stood rooted with horror, then she turned and ran. She thought she heard Jason running behind her. She couldn't be sure, but immediately after she heard him scream. In spite of her terror, she turned and looked behind her. At this point in her story, she became hysterical again, and several minutes passed before she could go on. She could not describe exactly what she had seen as she looked over her shoulder. The thing which she had glimpsed, rushing under the trees, had caught up with Jason. It almost completely covered him. All she could see of him was his agonized face and part of one arm, low near the ground, as if the thing were squatting astride him. She could not say what it was. It was black, formless, bestial, and yet not bestial. It was the dark, gliding kind of indescribable horror which she had shuddered at when she was a little girl alone in the nursery at night. She shuddered now and covered her eyes as she tried to picture what she had seen. Oh God, the darkness came alive. The darkness came alive. Somehow, she went on presently. She had stumbled through the trees into the road. She was so terrified she hardly noticed the approaching car. There could be no doubt that Dolores Rao was in the grip of a genuine terror. Chief Underbeck acted with clarity. After the white-faced girl had been driven to a nearby hospital for treatment of her scratches and the administration of a sedative, Underbeck rounded up all available men on the force, equipped them with shotguns, rifles, and flashlights, hurried them into four prowl cars, and started off for Wharton Swamp. Jason Buckmeyer's car was found where he had parked it. It had not been disturbed. A search of the nearby swamp area, conducted in the glare of flashlights, proved fruitless. Whatever had attacked Buckmeyer had apparently carried him off into the furthest recesses of the sprawling swamp. After two futile hours of brush-breaking and marsh-sloshing, Chief Underbeck wearily rounded up his men and called off the hunt until morning. As the first faint streaks of dawn appeared in the sky over Wharton Spring, the search began again. Reinforcements, including civilian volunteers from Clinton Center, had arrived, and a systematic combing of the entire swamp commenced. By noon, the search had proved fruitless, or nearly so. One of the searchers brought in a battered hat and a rye whiskey bottle, which he had discovered on the edge of the marsh under a sweet gum tree. The shapeless felt hat was odd and worn, but it was dry. It had therefore apparently been discarded in the swamp since the storm of a few days ago. The whiskey bottle looked new. In fact, a few drops of rye remained in it. The searcher reported that the remains of a small campfire were also found under the sweet gum. In the hope that this evidence might have some bearing on the disappearance of Jason Buckmeyer, Chief Underbeck ordered a canvass of every liquor store in Clinton Center in an attempt to learn the names of everyone who had recently purchased a bottle of the particular brand of rye found under the tree. The search went on, and mid-afternoon brought another, more ominous discovery. A diligent researcher investigating a trampled area in a large growth of cattails picked a rifle out of the mud. After the slime and dirt had been wiped away, two of the searchers vouched that it belonged to Rupert Barnaby. One of them had hunted with him and remembered a bit of scroll work on the rifle stock. While Chief Underbeck was weighing this unpalatable bit of evidence, a report of the liquor store canvass in Clinton Center arrived. Every recent purchaser of a quart bottle of the particular brand in question had been investigated. Only one could not be located, a tramp who had hung around the town for several days and had been ordered out. By evening, most of the exhausted search party were convinced that this tramp, probably in a state of homicidal viciousness brought on by drink, had murdered both Rupert Barnaby and Jason and secreted their bodies in one of the deep pools of the swamp. The chances were the murderer was still sleeping off the effects of drink somewhere in the tangled thickets of the marsh. Most of the searchers regarded Dolores Israel's melodramatic story with a great deal of skepticism. In the dim moonlight, they pointed out, a frenzied, wild-eyed tramp bent on imminent murder might very well have resembled some kind of monster, and the girl's hysteria had probably magnified what she had seen. As night closed over the dismal morass, Chief Underbeck reluctantly suspended the hunt. In view of the fact that the murderer probably still lurked in the woods, however, he decided to establish a system of night-long patrols along the highway which paralleled the swamp. If the quarry lay hidden in the treacherous tangle of trees and brush, he would not be able to escape onto the highway without running into one of the patrols. The only other means of egress from the swamp lay miles across the mire, where the open sea washed against a reedy beach, and it was quite unlikely that the fugitive would even attempt escape in that direction. The patrols were established in 3-hour shifts, 2 men to a patrol, both heavily armed and both equipped with powerful searchlights. They were ordered to investigate every sound or movement which they detected in the brush bordering the highway. After a single command to halt, they were to shoot to kill. Any curious motorists who stopped to inquire about the hunt were to be swiftly waved on their way after being warned not to give rides to anyone and to report all hitchhikers. Fred Storr and Luke Matson, on the midnight to 3 o'clock patrol, passed an uneventful 2 hours on the particular stretch of the highway. Matson finally sat down on a fallen tree stump a few yards from the edge of the road. "Legs given out," he commented wryly, resting his rifle on the stump. "Might as well sit a few minutes." Fred Storr lingered nearby. "Guess so, Luke. Don't look like..." Suddenly he scowled into the black fringes of the swamp. "You hear something, Luke?" Luke listened, twisting around in the stump. "Well, maybe," he said finally. "Kind of a little scratchy sound like." He got up, retrieving his rifle. "Let's take a look," Fred suggested in a low voice. He stepped over the stump and Luke followed him toward the tangle of brush which marked the border of the swamp jungle. Several yards further along, they stopped again. The sound became more audible. It was a kind of slithering, scraping sound, such as might be produced by a heavy body dragging itself over uneven ground. "Sounds like a snake," Luke ventured. "A damn big snake." "We'll get a little closer," Fred whispered. "You be ready with that gun when I switch on my light." They moved ahead a few more yards. Then a powerful yellow ray stabbed into the thicket ahead as Fred switched on his flashlight. The ray searched the darkness, probing in one direction and then another. Luke lowered his rifle a little, frowning. "Don't see a thing," he said. "Nothing but a big pool of black scum up ahead there." Before Fred had time to reply, the pool of black scum reared up into horrible life. In one hideous second, it hunched itself into an unspeakable glistening hood and rolled forward with fearful speed. Luke Matson screamed and fired simultaneously as the monstrous scarf of slime shot forward. A moment later, it swayed above him. He fired again, and the thing fell upon him. In avoiding the initial rush of the horror, Fred Storr lost his footing. He fell headlong and turned just in time to witness a sight which slowed the blood in his veins. The monster had pounced upon Luke Matson. Now, as Fred watched, literally paralyzed with horror, it spread itself over and around the form of Luke until he was completely enveloped. The faint writhing of his limbs could still be seen. Then the thing squeezed, swelling into a hood and flattening itself again, and the writhing ceased. As soon as the thing lifted and swung forward in his direction, Fred Storr, goaded by frantic fear, overcame the paralysis of horror which had frozen him. Grabbing the rifle which had fallen beside him, he aimed it at the shape of living slime and started firing. Pure terror possessed him as he saw that the shots were having no effect. The thing lunged towards him, to all visible appearances entirely oblivious to the rifle slugs tearing into its loathsome viscid mass. Acting out of some instinct which he himself could not have named, Fred Storr dropped the rifle and seized his flashlight, playing its powerful beam directly upon the onrushing horror. The thing stopped scant feet away and appeared to hesitate. It slid quickly aside at an angle, but he followed it immediately with a cone of light. It backed up finally and flattened out, as if trying by that means to avoid the light. But he trained the beam on it steadily, sensing with every primitive fiber which he possessed that the yellow shaft of light was the one thing which held off hideous death. Now there were shouts in the nearby darkness, and other lights began stabbing the shadows. Members of the adjacent patrols, alarmed by the sound of the rifle fire, had come running to investigate. Suddenly, the nameless horror squirmed quickly out of the flashlight's beam and rushed away in the darkness. In the leaden light of early dawn, Chief Underbeck climbed into a police car waiting on the highway near Wharton Swamp and headed back for Clinton Center. He had made a decision, and he was grimly determined to act on it at once. When he reached headquarters, he made 2 telephone calls in quick succession, one to the governor of the state and the other to the commander of the nearby Camp Evans Military Reservation. The horror in Wharton Swamp, he had decided, could not be coped with by the limited men and resources at his command. Rupert Barnaby, Jason Buchmeist, and Luke Matson had without any doubt perished in the swamp. The anonymous tramp, it now began to appear, far from being the murderer, had been only one more victim. And Fred Storr, well, he hadn't disappeared, but the other patrol members had found him sitting on the ground near the edge of the swamp, in the clutches of a mind-warping fear, which had temporarily, at least, reduced him to near idiocy. Hours after he had been taken home and put to bed, he had refused to loosen his grip on a flashlight, which he squeezed in one hand. When they switched the flashlight off, he screamed, and they had to switch it on again. His story was so wildly melodramatic it could scarcely be accepted by rational minds. And yet, they had said as much about Dolores Rell's hysterical account. And Fred Storr was no excitable young girl. He had a reputation for level-headedness, stolidity, and verbal honesty, which was touch with understatement rather than exaggeration. As Chief Underbeck arose and walked out to his car in order to start back to Wharton Swamp, he noticed Old Man Gauss coming down the block. With a sudden thrill of horror, he remembered the eccentric's missing cow. Before the old man came abreast, he slammed the car door and issued crisp directions to the waiting driver. As the car sped away, he glanced in the rearview mirror. Old Man Gauss stood grimly motionless on the walk in front of police headquarters. "Old Man Cassandra," Chief Underbeck muttered. The driver shot a swift glance at him and stepped on the gas. Less than 2 hours after Chief Underbeck arrived back at Wharton Swamp, the adjacent highway was crowded with cars. State police patrol cars, cars of the local curious, and army trucks from Camp Evans. Promptly at 9 o'clock, over 300 soldiers, police, and citizen volunteers, all armed, swung into the swamp to begin a careful search. Shortly before dusk, most of them had arrived at the sea on the far side of the swamp. Their exhaustive efforts had netted nothing. One soldier, noticing fierce eyes glaring out of a tree, had bagged an owl, and one of the state policemen had flushed a young bobcat. Someone else had stepped on a copperhead and been treated for snakebite. But there was no sign of a monster, a murderous tramp, nor any of the missing men. In the face of mounting skepticism, Chief Underbeck stood firm, pointing out that so far as they knew to date, the murderer prowled only at night. He ordered that after a 4-hour rest and meal period, the search should continue. A number of helicopters, which had hovered over the area during the afternoon, landed on the strip of shore, bringing food and supplies. At Chief Underbeck's insistence, barriers were set up on the beach. Guards were stationed along the entire length of the highway. Powerful searchlights were brought up. Another truck from Camp Evans arrived with a portable machine gun and several flamethrowers. By 11 o'clock that night, the stage was set. The beach barriers were in place, guards were at station, and huge searchlights erected near the highway swept the dismal marsh with probing cones of light. At 11:15, the night patrols, each consisting of 10 strongly armed men, struck into the swamp again. Ravenous with hunger, the hood of horror reared out of the mud at the bottom of a rancid pool and rose towards the surface. Flopping ashore in the darkness, it slid quickly away over the clumps of scattered swamp grass. It was impelled, as always, by a savage and enormous hunger. Although hunting in its new environment had been good, its immense appetite knew no appeasement. The more food it consumed, the more it seemed to require. As it rushed off, alert to the minute vibrations which indicated food, it became aware of various disturbing emanations. Although it was the time of darkness in this strange world, the darkness at this usual hunting period was oddly pierced by the monster's hated enemy, light. The food vibration were stronger than the shape of slime had ever experienced. They were on all sides, powerful, purposeful, moving in many directions all through the lower layers of puzzling, light-driven darkness. Lifting out of the ooze, the hood of horror floated up a latticework of gnarled swamp snags and hung motionless, while drops of muddy water rolled off its glistening surface and dripped below. The thing's sensory apparatus told it that the manning streaks or lack of darkness were everywhere. Even as it hung suspended on the snags like a great filthy carpet coated with slime, a terrible touch of light slashed through the surrounding darkness and burnt against it. It immediately loosened its hold on the snags and fell back into the ooze with a mighty plop. Nearby, the vibration suddenly increased its intensity. The maddening streamers of light shot through the darkness on all sides. Baffled and savage, the thing plunged into the ooze and propelled itself in the opposite direction. But this proved to be only a temporary respite. The vibrations redoubled in intensity. The darkness almost disappeared, riven and pierced by bolts and rivers of light. For the first time in its incalculable existence, the thing experienced something vaguely akin to fear. The light could not be snatched up and squeezed and smothered to death. It was not an alien enemy against which the hood of horror had learned only one defense: flight, hiding. And now, in its world of darkness, was torn apart by sudden floods and streamers of light, the monster instinctively sought the refuge afforded by that vast black cradle from which it had climbed. Flinging itself through the swamp, it headed back for sea. The guard patrol stationed along the beach, roused by the sound of gunfire and urgent shouts of warning from the interior of the swamp, stood or knelt with ready weapons as the clamor swiftly approached the sea. The dismal, reedy beach lay fully exposed in the harsh glare of searchlights. Waves rolled in towards shore, splashing white crests of foam far up the sands. In the searchlight's illumination, The dark waters glisten with an oily iridescence. The shrill cries increased. The watchers tensed, waiting, and suddenly across the long, dreary flats, clotted with weed stalks and sunken drifts, there burst into view a nightmare shape which froze the shore patrols in their tracks. A thing of slimy blackness. A thing which had no essential shape, no discernible earthly features, rushed through the thorn thickets and into the flats. It was a shape of utter darkness. 1 second a great flapping hood, the next a black viscid pool of living ooze, which flowed upon itself, sliding forward with incredible speed. Some of the guards remained rooted where they stood, too overcome with horror to pull the trigger of their weapons. Others broke the spell of terror and began firing. Bullets from half a dozen rifles tore into the black monster speeding across the mud flats. As the thing neared the end of the flats and approached the first sand dunes of the open beach, the patrol guards who had flushed it from the swamp broke into the open. One of them paused, bellowing at the beach guard. "It's heading for sea. For God's sake, don't let it escape." The beach guards redoubled their firing, suddenly realizing with a kind of sick horror that the monster was apparently unaffected by the rifle slugs. Without a single pause, it rolled through the last fringe of cattails and flopped into the sands. As in a hideous nightmare, the guards saw it flap over the nearest sand dune and slide towards the sea. A moment later, however, they remembered the barbed wire beach barrier, which Chief Underbeck had stubbornly insisted on their erecting. Gaining heart, they closed in, running over the dunes towards the spot where the black horror would strike the wire. Someone in the lead yelled in sudden triumph, "It's caught! It's stuck on the wire!" The searchlights concentrated swaths of light on the barrier. The thing had reached the barbed wire fence and apparently flung itself against the twisted strands. Now it appeared to be hopelessly caught. It twisted and flopped and squirmed like some unspeakable giant jellyfish snared in a fisherman's net. The guards ran forward, sure of their victory. All at once, however, the guard in the lead screamed a wild warning. "It's squeezing through! It's getting away!" In the glare of light, they saw with concentration that the monster appeared to be flowing through the wire like a blob of liquescent ooze. Ahead lay a few yards of downward slanting beach and beyond that, rolling breakers of the open sea. There was a collective gasp of horrified dismay as the monster, with a quick forward lurch, squeezed through the barrier. It tilted there briefly, twisting as if a few last threads of itself might still be entangled in the wire. As it moved to disengage itself and rush down the wet sand into the black sea, one of the guards hurled himself forward until he was almost abreast of the barrier. Sliding to his knees, he aimed at the escaping hood of horror. A second later, a great searing spout of flame shot from his weapon and burst in a smoky red blossom against the thing on the opposite side of the wire. Black oily smoke billowed into the night. A ghastly stench flowed over the beach. The guards saw a flaming mass of horror grope away from the barrier. The soldier, who aimed a flamethrower, held it remorselessly steady. There was a hideous bubbling, hissing sound. Vast gouts of thick, greasy smoke swirled into the night air. The indescribable stench became almost unbearable. When the soldier finally shut off the flamethrower, there was nothing in sight except the white, hot, glowing wires of the barrier and a big patch of blackened sand. With good reason, the mantle of slime had hated light, for its ultimate source was fire, the final unknown enemy, which even the black hood could not drag down and devour.